Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sileri Report. We are recording on Wednesday, November 9th for publication on Thursday, November 10th. This is John Titus, Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm back in the Netherlands, and it was quite a trip. And it was interesting, John, wherever I went, everyone said, Europe is going to freeze to death this winter and you'll die in a nuclear war. I don't think so. But it's amazing how the corporate media is still getting through more than we would wish. But it's great to be back. And we are now watching the results of the election, which are, as my uncle who was in the army used to say, stupefying. And it reminds us of the importance of our theme, which is?
Well, yeah, remedies and the rule of law, which we'll get to. It's not the strongest thing we've ever had when we get to it kind of obliquely. But the notion of a remedy at law is really, it's not just compensating someone for damage done. It's really getting things back to the status quo ante.
Right.
The status quo as it existed immediately before the harm was incurred.
Right. And we keep watching calls for amnesty related
right.
to COVID. So,
right.
you know, we stole $1 trillion and destroyed your businesses, but forgive us. And
yeah.
There's this fog around accountability and the fact that when you steal people's money and their businesses, you have an obligation under the law to make restitution.
Right. But the view of the powers that be is, well, let's just wash our hands and move on. Now, that was too bad, but, let's just look forward, not backward. And that was Obama started that in his first term. We want to look forward, not backward, meaning we're not going to prosecute Wall Street. That's what that meant.
Right. So crime that pays is crime that stays.
Right.
And it's really important. If we want to have the rule of law, then people have to be accountable under the law. And that includes serious, real remedies, which
right.
is available under the law. We just have to apply the law.
Yeah. Right. Right. Obama also meant, by the way, we're going to ignore war criminals in the Bush administration. Well, can't dwell on that too much. We have more wars to prosecute.
Right.
Yeah.
They are very good at protecting each other.
It's
extraordinary.
Are.
Yes. Yep. Okay. Okay. Well, let's dive in.
Okay. Let's dive in with war in Ukraine. The first story, this is from an official arm of Russia. And so it's very long, but it concerns the finding of biological weapons in the Ukraine by Russia, by the Russian army. And they have this long statement here to the United Nations. And I'm just going to scroll down and just kind of hone in quickly on the basic problem here. In Odessa, we found basically 422 cholera storage units and 32 anthrax storage units. So these are very specific allegations. Notable is a large number of test tubes that contain the same strains of different passages of these pathogens. In addition, on March 9th, on the territory of Kherson region, the forces of Russia Federation discovered 3 unmanned aerial vehicles equipped with 30-liter containers and equipment which can be used to spray these bioagents. In late April, 10 more drones of the same type were found in the area of Kakhovka. So Russia goes on and on and on and on with these very specific allegations to the UN saying, hey, they've documented them all. What are you going to do about this? And basically nothing ever happens. And Russia concludes to the UN, neither the US nor Ukraine responded to our questions either in Geneva or in the case of the US here today. And that just really summarizes in a nutshell what it's like for Russia to deal with the US. You have all these allegations and U.S. is like, I can't see you or hear you. I don't. Yeah.
So there are a lot of allegations regarding spraying of these and testing of these kinds of sort of agents on the Ukraine population.
Right.
And I don't know if that's what they're implying by having the, describing the drones and the spraying capacity. But The U.S. keeps saying these were defensive capabilities, and it's clearly not their offensive capabilities.
Right. They're right on the border of Russia, and they have no legitimate purpose.
Right.
And they're there in volume.
And my understanding is it's illegal under international law to have these.
Right.
Right.
Right. That's what I mean. There's no legitimate purpose. They're illegal.
Right.
Right. And the U.S. is just like, oh, it just never responds to the allegations. Nothing's ever done. And that's what it's like to deal with a regime in the U.S. that's run by psychopathic criminals.
Well, remember, you have, what, 30 of these installations in the Ukraine and 300 worldwide.
Right. Yeah. Big numbers. Yeah.
We had one in Wuhan and that the U.S. was financing.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
So anyway, that's kind of the backdrop on Ukraine. By way of that background, let's go to our next story in Ukraine. And this is, you know, this is from the Washington Post. U.S. privately asked Ukraine to show Russia it's open to negotiation. The duplicity is right out in the front now. Look at this. The Biden administration is supposedly privately encouraging Ukraine's leaders to signal an openness to negotiate with Russia and drop their public refusal to engage in peace talks. But look at this. The request by American officials is not aimed at pushing Ukraine to the negotiating table, the people familiar with the matter said. Rather, they called it a calculated attempt to ensure the government in Kiev maintains the support of other nations facing constituencies wary of feeling a war. So we need to placate some people in Europe. And then the Post says, the discussions illustrate how complex the Biden administration's position on the Ukraine has become. Well, complex is one word. Right. Duplicitous is another word, and deceitful is yet a third word.
Right.
Nothing complex about it. You're lying, and this is just a head fake in bad faith.
Right.
Yeah. That's our policy.
Right.
And then if you go to the next story in Ukraine, it's more of the same, this time from Zelensky. Russia says major dam hit by U.S.-supplied HIMARS rocket. HIMARS rockets being made by Lockheed Martin, who we'll see a little bit of in a minute. Today at 10 a.m., there was a hit of 6 HIMARS rockets. Air Defense Unit shot down 5 of them, but one hit a lock in the Kakhovka Dam, which was damaged. Russian news agency quoted local emergency authorities as saying. Now, if you look at this, before this happened, Zelensky had appealed to world powers to ensure the dam's safe operation by sending an international mission to protect and operate it, pointing out that if the dam burst, it could cause a catastrophe on a grand scale. And yet here we have, Zelensky has been warning about a false flag detonation. And then in the end, what happens is the dam gets hit by U.S.-made rockets made by the U.S.
Right. And the potential implications for civilians would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
Right.
Does Zelensky ever explain, like, well, how did the Russians get a hold of Lockheed Martin HIMARS? He doesn't, of course not. It's so obvious who's behind this.
Right.
No. It's just incredible. It's going to be very frustrating. You know, the whole thing in the Ukraine is just war is just going to continue to go on, obviously. Right?
So the problem is it's so goofy that I think it's hard. You know, what I saw in the United States is most people have given up trying to track any of this because the reports are so without any basis in fact. They just... You know, they've decided these guys are going to do whatever they want and, they're going to lie about everything. And so why bother even paying any attention to the whole thing?
Right.
Right.
I read these stories. I've lost patience with it myself. I just have to sort of grin and bear it when I go through stories like these. And it's just more of the same.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway.
Okay.
So
pray
we
for
know
the
we
people of the Ukraine.
We said at the outset that this was going to go on back in February. This is going to go on a long time,
right?
And it is because remember, whenever you see a major war, major global conflict, there's always a major monetary change underfoot every single time.
Right.
No
well, we're going to get to the charts, and what the chart shows is that it's likely to get much worse.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Right.
But in the meantime, let's leave Ukraine, thankfully, and move on to global turf wars. One story this week, I don't really know what to, what's going on there? Oh, here we go. I don't really know what to make of this one. Maybe you have a take. Lula presidential win, a boost for Brazil-China ties and BRICS, say experts. Okay. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's victory in Brazil's runoff election on Sunday will help strengthen ties with China, Brazil's top trading partner in BRICS countries, according to analysts. The leftist heavyweight had open dialogue with Beijing during his first administration and in 2009 helped Brazil form BRICS. So this guy was there at the beginning. And there you see that picture from back in the day. That election, so let's just go on a little more. Trade between China and Brazil hit a record $135 billion last year, marking four consecutive years of growth despite the COVID-19 pandemic. And it must be pointed out, despite the absence of, you know, Da Silva. China's relationship with Brazil cooled when Bolsonaro took office in 2019 as tensions grew over China's economic dominance and the origins of COVID-19. Now, that said, there are plenty of allegations swirling about that that election was rigged and it really went to Bolsonaro.
Right.
And I have no way of assessing.
Right. And the implication was the U.S. wanted Da Silva. So
the implication, right, is the U.S. wanted Da Silva. And did the powers that be wanted Da Silva, despite the fact, interestingly, that as the story points out, this is supposed to strengthen BRICS.
Right.
So,
it's,
in other words,
I would say it's very muddled, but there is a big issue now, given what is now happening with China, whether the South will go with China and Russia or go with the U.S. So, but it's very murky.
Yes. It is murky. Right. But if those allegations are true, it's noteworthy that you have another example of the power structure in the U.S. operating in a way that is not in the country's interests.
Right.
To strengthen BRICS. That's, you know, so, but like you say, it is very, very murky. So, by the way, let's just move to something that we're more familiar with, and that's the U.S., where we have had elections. It is the morning right now. We're recording after the election. So I'm sure there'll be continue to be follow-up. But let's
did we have elections or did we have a theater?
Well, that's a really good question. Hold that thought while we look at this next story. It's really a chart. The biggest donors of the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. Here you go. Here they are. I only recognize some of these names. George Soros, obviously, I recognize, $129 million. Sam Bankman-Fried, he's a crypto guy.
Right.
Ken Griffin, he's Citadel. You know, he's a high-frequency trading guy. Schwartzman's an investment guy. Ellison's head of Oracle. Anyway.
I wanted to look at this chart because I'm used to Soros leading the pack.
Yeah.
But not by this much. It's an incredible amount of money.
You're right. That is a gaping lead between...
Right.
Secretariat in front and a donkey in number two. That's a massive lead.
And, you know, I have not looked at Soros recently, but the last time I did look at Soros, I just assumed that most of the money that Soros was using to do this came from the equivalent of insider trading.
But if you look, though, Catherine, if you look at this, this Bankman-Fried really isn't number two. It's really... this Yulin and Ken Griffin.
Right.
I mean, it's still a massive lead. But the number two and three, they do add up to number one.
Yep. No, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree, but it's amazing how few people, well, in my experience, a lot of these people are not, you know, they're not principals for themselves. They're basically channeling money for a syndicate.
Yes, they're channeling money for a syndicate, and they're not, like you said, they're not people engaged really in productive enterprise. They're engaged in, how do I get your money to work for me? How do I get your money out of your pocket and into my pocket?
Well, but a lot of it is using government money to rig things.
Yes.
So you buy the political structure so that you can command the federal credit and the federal appropriations to rig your deals.
Right. So. But that chart, though, the oligarchy is out there in the open. Those numbers are staggering.
Right.
And it's just like, okay, your government's for sale.
Right.
Meanwhile, on Main Street, take a look at the story from Mish. Record 7% surge small business rent delinquency in October. These numbers are staggering. I had to look at this for a while. This is so what they've got here is this is October versus September. That's the change. That's in other words, that column is just the delta. Okay. The real numbers are here. Okay. Right. Here are the October numbers. Look at the size of these numbers. So education, 57% businesses in rent delinquency. And look at the changes. If you just scan the change from early in the year right. to now, look at the jumps you're talking about.
Right.
Okay. So let's take gyms. Okay. I go to the gym. 25-23% at the beginning of the year, it's 40% now.
Right.
What's that, 67% increase? Everybody pretty much is up with precious few exceptions. Manufacturing seems to be kind of holding steady. But those are shocking numbers, Catherine.
Right. I mean, you're talking about a quarter to a half of small businesses going out of business by the, you know, in short order.
Yeah. Mish points out here, this delinquency, this jump of 7%, it's the largest jump in 2022, which as we just saw, was pretty robust to begin with on a yearly right. basis.
Right.
That's not a good story.
No.
That paints a very grim picture.
Okay. Well, wait till I get to Skidmore's numbers. It's going to get grimmer.
Skidmore's numbers.
Yeah. Did you get the chart from Justin on, well, I'll describe it. I'll do it now. Cause this basically backs, you know, what you've been saying. So Skidmore did a calculation. It's up at, he's put it up at Lighthouse Economics. And he looked at the total estimate of revenues for the federal government for 2023.
Uh-huh.
And he estimated total is 4.6, but 1.5 trillion of that is for Social Security. So a net of Social Security, 3.1 trillion of payments to the government. Now that doesn't count borrowing. That's right. Just taxes, fees, everything else. So then he calculates that interest payments at the current level of interest rates, but given the rise, so an average yield of 4.57, that 48% of federal revenues net of Social Security will be dedicated to interest payments.
But to be clear, that's not the percentage right now, 48%.
No.
That's hypothetical.
Hypothetical for 2023.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
However, if interest rates continue to rise to 5.5%, it will be 55% of federal revenues. If interest rates rise to 6.5, it will be 65% of federal revenues just going to pay the interest on the debt, which means, you know, as you've been pointing out for many weeks now, you're going to have to borrow significant amounts of money to pay the interest on the debt.
Right.
Right. So at the very time that you're in the spiral up in your debt at the federal level, you know, and that federal money has been crowding out the small business economy and being used to destroy the small business economy, you are destroying the small business economy that you need to be productive to generate the health that will get you out of this. So, you know, basically what you're in a debt spiral, but you're destroying all the muscle in your economy.
Right. You're in a bad trap.
Right.
Yeah. You're struggling to get out of the bear trap, but you're tearing muscle.
Right. And I'm going to bring this back to what's happening with China, Russia, and what's happening in our economy at sort of the big picture level, but we'll get there.
Yeah, boy, it's not looking good. We'll see how long these interest rate increases increase. I think the Fed's going to increase until something breaks, and something's going to break.
Well, if you look at the Eurodollar futures curve, something's going to break January to March. In other words, you're talking about the curve showing a very significant deflation. And that was the conversation we were having on that yesterday, which is, you know, when will the Fed pivot? And if you get a deflationary spiral like that, will they pivot?
Right. We shall see.
I have to tell you, you've heard me say this a couple times now for the last 2 weeks. When I was in America driving, so I drove all the way from the Panhandle to Knoxville and then up to Pennsylvania. Everywhere I went, John, it looked like just incredible prosperity.
Yeah,
and
right.
My guess was it was just a gusher of fiscal and central bank subsidy.
Yep.
You know, that's coming from this and everyone looked as though they thought the good times were rolling. They didn't know there was a problem. Right.
I know people going on vacation, people going on multiple vacations, like that money's illusory.
Right.
Anyway.
It was astonishing.
Okay. Let's keep it going with another kind of grim story, but it's just a telltale story from the BBC. Bank of England expects UK to fall into longest ever recession. Oh, okay. Let's see what's going on here. The Bank of England has warned the UK will see its longest recession since records began as it raised interest rates by the most in 33 years. So get this. The bank believes that by raising interest rates, it will make it more expensive to borrow and encourage people not to spend money and thus easing pressure on prices. So, in other words, the Bank of England is the culprit. The Bank of England is causing the problem. We're going to have a worse recession because we're raising rates.
I think the Bank of England is describing a system where the tapeworm is eating a certain part of the host, right? And making, engorging the other part of the host. So,
yeah.
So you basically have the central bank injecting money into the economy to their pals. Their pals kick up the inflation, and to offset that inflation, you just shut down your enemy's businesses.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Bye-bye small business. Right. We don't need you anymore.
Longest recession ever. Okay. Let's keep it going with mortgage layoffs. So this is an interesting article. This guy, Colin Robertson, I'm not familiar with him, but he says, I first created this list of mortgage layoffs and closures in February 2007. And so he, by way of that background, he says, you know, that's obviously that everybody knows what happened back then. 86,000 mortgage jobs were cut in 2007, and we know what happened next. So now let's flash forward to his list. The latest update on November 7th, 2022. And he's got this long, long list. And just kind of so we can scan it quickly, I highlighted where over 500 jobs were cut, just as sort of an arbitrary cutoff. I mean, I don't, 24. Yeah, I'm sorry they lost their jobs, but it's not that many. So 800, 550. And you can get a feel for HomePoint, 526, Loan Depot, 4,800, Chase, 1,000. Notice Chase is 1,000 home lending jobs. In other words, you know that the mortgage jobs are way over 1,000. They're just being very specific to be political. Redfin, 500, and on and on and on, 3,000 by Better Mortgage. You know, you've got basically 12,000 jobs cut in the mortgage space right there.
Right.
Right. So we're getting back into that in an environment of rising interest rates.
Right.
You know, we're in uncharted territory right now.
Right. Although home sales, from what I saw, have not cooled that much. You know,
right. They've
cooled down some, but the market in Pennsylvania and Tennessee was very healthy still.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I say this every week, you know, I check bank deposits all the time, and bank deposits are dropping totally in total. But remember, a large part of that is QE.
Right.
If you know, that's what's doing it. Quantitative tightening is going on, and that's causing bank deposits to drop. If you look at what historically is a large component of bank deposits, which is loans, lending is still on fire.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Bank, if you go to the Fed's charts, the Fred website, and type in loans and leases, get eyeball that chart. It's a line.
Right.
Not, it's just like, it's as if the Fed had never touched interest rates. It's astonishing. So people, like, again, it's like 1990, party like it's 1999. People are still borrowing.
Right.
Someone's borrowing. Yeah. Okay.
Well, as I said, there was a tsunami of money when I drove through.
Yeah. Okay. I got to laugh at this next story. Remember last week we had a story about the Fed who was operating at a loss.
Right.
Because they're basically, they got a bunch of stuff on their balance sheet that's paying 2% and they're paying out 3% and 4%. Right. So, it's a cash furnace. This is a different story. It's another central bank, Swiss National Bank, loses nearly $143 billion in the first 9 months. That's a big number for them. The Swiss National Bank lost 142.2 billion Swiss francs in the first 9 months of 2022. It said on Monday is rising interest rates. Look what they blame here. Rising interest rates and the stronger Swiss franc slashed the value of the central bank's foreign investments. Okay, so how do we parse out those two things? 50-50? No. They made the loss of 141 billion francs from its foreign currency positions. So out of the loss, out of the 142 billion loss, 141 billion of it was from foreign currency positions. Sounds like interest rates, you know, maybe not it had that much to do with it. It was more like your foreign currency positions are sort of the dominant element there. Is that not unbelievable?
Well, but the Swiss have a real problem because when, you know, when people get concerned about safety, they rush into the franc and it drives the Swiss franc up and it wreaks havoc. I mean, I would hate to be the president of Swatch Watch because you're trying to export and the franc's just flying up.
But yeah, I understand that the machinations may be a little more complex.
Right.
But at least acknowledge that there's an explanation there that needs to be ventured on why 141 out of 142 are coming from foreign currency swaps, you know?
Well, are they coming from swaps or losses on the investment portfolio?
It looked like swaps, but
I think, because, you know, they had huge equity. It really rang the bell back in, I forget when it was, 2012 or so, when they started to buy an equity portfolio. They have a pretty significant equity portfolio, and they could have taken a big drop this year on the equity portfolio. So I wouldn't assume it swaps.
That's a big number.
Right.
And it's interesting that, you know, you have two very sort of luminary central banks, the Fed and the Swiss National Bank, both operating at a loss.
Operating a loss or choosing to operate at a loss. I would describe it as
They're choosing to operate at a loss.
Right.
The Fed's loss is coming from the fact that they're paying interest on reserves, on excess reserves, because all reserves now are excess reserves.
But they're
right?
choosing. I mean, notice that sentence. If you go back to the article where it says, you know, it's not a problem because they can just print money.
Right.
Right,
that's exactly what they said there. It's not a problem because they can print money. Okay, let's move on to what do we got next? I want to go to
FedWatch.
FedWatch, but it's other forms of control.
Right.
Although this is kind of borderline. It's a good transition article. CEOs cutting back or pausing their ESG efforts, according to a KPMG study. In August, KPMG published an in-depth report titled 2022 U.S. CEO Outlook, which said 79% of CEOs think the public will look to the private sector to address major social challenges rather than to governments, be it climate change or income equality. But what are they doing, these CEOs? The key finding from the report was that 59% of the CEOs say they plan to pause or reconsider their ESG efforts in the next 6 months to help prepare for the anticipated recession. How about that? So they've got their finger to the wind.
Right.
People don't like that stuff.
So because I have a screen company and Solari Investment Screens goes through lots and lots of annual wrap-ups, annual reports and reports by these companies, I cannot tell you how much money is wasted on ESG reports. It is frightening. And the variability between what they say in their ESG report and reality, it reaches a level of amusement that is just, you know, it's like intergalactic amusement.
I'll
never forget reading the ESG report and the community report for JP Morgan. And I swear, I don't know who wrote it, but they obviously knew nothing about JP Morgan and were freed from any connection to reality. It was really impressive. I mean, it was beautiful. It sounded great. You know, but a lot of money has been wasted in corporate America on ESG in the last 5 years.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that the CEOs are, they're in tune with that and the frustration with it.
Right. And I'll tell you why, because in my experience, most CEOs, you know, have to hold themselves and their leadership to very high standards of productivity. And it's really irritating when things get as serious and risky as they are now to waste money on that. And it's also a legal issue because, you know, at some point, if it gets too far away from reality, that's a legal liability. You're creating all sorts of promises you can't and won't keep.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But the fingers to the wind, and I think that's going on in a lot of places. Just anecdotally, I can tell you, I wandered into a Barnes & Noble the other night looking for a little calendar book. And as I was walking out, I happened to see on a table a book that I own. It's called Big Dirty Money by Jennifer Taub. It's not particularly good. It's a whitewash to basically the financial crisis. But I looked at the table. I paused and sat there and looked at it. And all these books are about the coming depression and, you know, shenanigans and crimes by Wall Street and all this other stuff. And I'm thinking, this company is aware that people know there's trouble and they're looking right. for why.
Right.
You know. And that CEO report is sort of the same thing. They're back. Those CEOs love that. They love ESG. For them, for three out of five of them to back off tells me there's a lot of pushback. They're sensing something.
Well, I'll tell you where you really see it. You see it in the energy area. I told you I was talking with someone yesterday about the new government in Sweden. They had 12 nuclear plants. They shut down six, and now they don't have enough electricity.
Yeah.
When people are cold.
Wow.
I used to have a partner at Dillon Radio would say this, you know, we're down to nut cutting time.
Yeah.
When you shut down six plants and then can't provide energy, there's a real political issue.
Yeah. You got a political issue on your hands when people are cold, hungry, they're not making their rent.
They don't want to hear about ESG.
No, they don't want to hear about ESG.
Right.
They want to hear about why are we in this mess? What criminals did this?
Right.
You know, Barnes & Noble picked, you know, this is a big display in the center of the store I'm talking about. This isn't some far away in a corner. Anyway, I'm hardly ever in that store. What is going on in this place? You know, normally Barnes & Noble is the land of like the happy, everything's great, wonderful, go back to Facebook, you know.
Right.
Anyway, okay, let's keep it going. The next story from the Wall Street Journal. Interesting. Chief Justice Roberts temporarily blocks House access to Trump's tax returns. What's going on here? He temporarily blocked the House committee from obtaining Donald Trump's tax returns, issuing an admin order Tuesday suggesting the Supreme Court won't act on the emergency plea by Trump to shield his finances from congressional investigators until after next week's midterms. Tuesday's order gives the House Ways and Means Committee until noon on November 10th to file its response, after which the Chief Justice or the full court could act on Trump's request. The backdrop to this is Trump never delivered on his 2016 campaign pledge to release his tax returns. Note this, a custom followed by every major party. So it's just it's not law that he puts those tax returns. Right. So I think that's really what Roberts is doing here. In other words, it's really a political question. It's a political custom. So he's treating it politically by kicking it until after the midterms. That's all.
Right. Right.
It's not really a legal issue, he's saying.
It is not really a legal issue because it would have, depending on what came out, it would have grabbed the headlines. We would have wasted a lot of headline space on Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. It's a political issue. They're trying to convert it to a legal issue, which I suppose they could if the House Ways and Means Committee pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, it could become a legal issue, but it's not yet. Anyway, the battle with Trump just continues. It's incredible. Right. Okay, next story. This is from Deal Breaker. This is about the longest serving LIBOR manipulator from Credit Suisse won't be going back to jail. This is an interesting one. The shenanigans, interesting choice of terms, not the crimes, the shenanigans, which led to more than $9 billion in global fines against the banks charged with setting it, were the work of more than, they're saying it's fair to say that it was more than just five relatively young traders who actually ended up in prison who caused the $9 billion in global fines for manipulating LIBOR. But they point out, this article says, LIBOR manipulation is no longer illegal on this side, on the U.S. side of the Atlantic. And so that's why this guy, Tom Hayes, is not going to, he's going to finally get out of jail and he's not going back to jail. What is interesting about this is this LIBOR manipulation is no longer illegal on this side of the Atlantic. If you click this, there's a link there which you can't really see because I highlighted it. But get a load of this. I'm going to click this link, and there it goes, takes you to another Deal Breaker article, which I've highlighted. So it turns out LIBOR manipulation wasn't actually legal under U.S. law. Why? Because the government failed to prove that LIBOR submissions did not comply with certain regulations or were false or misleading. In other words, it was the DOJ failing to prove up its case that makes it not illegal, which is not really not illegal. It just means the prosecutors
failed to make their case.
They failed to make the case. That doesn't mean LIBOR manipulation is now legal. It just means the government did what the government does in the pockets of Wall Street, which is favor the Wall Street buddies. Not kosher, not okay, not legal. Still illegal. You just failed to make your case. But
Jesus.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
The way the paper is trying to spin that is like, oh, it's not illegal anymore. Really? They failed to make their case.
They forgot to mention the story that nobody important
If they had made their case, they would have been in jail. Yeah, you get it? Because it is illegal. Unbelievable.
Well, but it's another crime that pays as crime that stays story because, you know, you're only going after the junior guys. You're not going after the people who run it. You're not holding the institutions liable as right. long as the DOJ gets a percent of the action.
Right.
It's a kickback scheme.
Right. Yep. It's a kickback scheme.
It is a kickback. It's a public-private partnership.
Yep. And it's business as usual.
Right.
And the DOJ is in on it. Can't prove Mickey Mouse cases. You can't prove Mickey Mouse cases. We can prove them on Main Street. 1,000 cases of fraud on Main Street, no problem at all. But against the Credit Suisse trader, fell down, couldn't do it. Sorry, better luck next time. Oh, by the way, it's not illegal. Okay. Unbelievable. Here's another story. Let's go to another story where Main Street takes the brunt of it. Wall Street Journal, CVS Walgreens to pay more than $10 billion to settle opioid lawsuits. Okay?
Yep.
The two largest drugstore chains said they reached a framework to settle the collection of lawsuits brought by governments and Native American tribes, blaming pharmacies for helping fuel the nation's opioid epidemic. Here we go. Look at this. But the settlement—
There won't be direct payments to families or individuals. The money going to go to DOJ?
The victims remain uncompensated, they don't say. But look at this. In August, a federal judge in Ohio ordered CVS and Walmart to pay $650 million over 15 years to two Ohio counties. That's a big number for two counties out of probably 100, okay?
Right.
Along the same lines, we have in March, CVS agreed to pay basically $500 million to settle opioid-related claims by the state of Florida, one of 50 states. They're getting off easy here for $10 billion, right?
Well, here's the thing. If you look at some of the counties, like the Ohio counties, I don't know the specifics on these, but if you look at their expenses, it's astonishing how much the counties have had to pay in terms of emergency services and other things for opioid.
Right.
So there is some compensation to counties, which is legitimate.
Right.
Oftentimes, what you see in situations like this is the money goes into DOJ. It doesn't go to compensate the families or the depositors or the people hurt.
Yeah.
And it just enriches the enforcement arm, you know, to go do more Sheriff of Nottingham.
Right. It does go to states and counties, but notably, it does not go to the victims.
Right.
But I want to cut back to one more thing in the story and point this out. Look at this. This is with our theme. CVS Chief Executive Karen Lynch said the statement is, it's in the best interest of all parties and helps put a decades-old issue behind us, this settlement. So let's just forget about the whole thing and put it behind us.
Well, here's the thing. You know, if you look at the opioid epidemic, part of what was happening was genocide. Part of what was happening was murder.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, very few, if any, people have been held accountable legally.
Yeah.
So, again, it comes back to if you make money committing genocide, you can be held responsible to share a percentage of it to the governmental entities that bore some of the expense brunt.
Right.
But no one gets held accountable for genocide or murder.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. It's just swept under the huge corporate umbrella. CVS and Walgreens will cut a pretty big check, but not that big given the size of the individual jury findings. And we'll be done with it. We'll call it a day. We'll just move forward.
So last year I wrote a book review on a book called The Empire of Pain about the Sacklers, who are at the heart of the opioid scandal.
Right.
And it's if you want to know more, I recommend it's very well written, and it's a very important story to understand that this was absolutely, in my opinion, a move to commit genocide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no doubt in my mind about that.
Right.
Given everything else I've seen and given what we just saw during the pandemic.
Right.
You know, and the video we saw last week of the clots coming out of a beating heart. That was just astonishing.
Right.
Yeah. I have no difficulty whatsoever believing that that was a genocide. None. Yeah.
Well, it took me a long time. I didn't think they would do a genocide this early out of the box. And it took me until I saw the Skidmore survey to use the word genocide. And of course, now with some of the information that's come out in the last 2 months, including something we're going to talk about today, it's clear it was a genocide.
That video we saw last week, that kind of put the hook in me, like, you got to be kidding me. The doctors are in on this.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, how do you see something like that? It just, how do you erase that out of your head?
You can't.
You don't.
You know,
yeah, unless you're getting paid to. Okay, let's move to CBDC and crypto. This next thing, this is a sort of a late entrant story, but this is a big deal.
Big deal.
LBRY, I'm just going to call it library, loss against SEC threatens to make Ether a security. Crypto boosters fear. This is a judge, a district court judge, okay, a federal judge in New Hampshire. Ruled Monday that video hosting platform Library illegally sold its native token to U.S. investors in a win for the SEC that could pave the way for other more popular digital assets to be labeled securities and regulated similarly to stocks and bonds. So in other words, what Library did is it sold its token, it sold a security
right,
without registering it with the SEC. That was the problem. Jeremy Kaufman, the founder of Library, argued on Twitter that the standard put forward by the judge in his ruling means that almost every cryptocurrency, including Ether and Dogecoin, are also securities. And he's right about that.
He's right about that.
He's exactly right about that. And that's really it. So the question is, well, what is it that makes those things a security? And I reached out to someone who's really active in crypto coins, and he said, well, the deal is the reason Bitcoin's not in there is a security is it every Bitcoin is mined. There isn't a central group of people behind right. Bitcoin. Bitcoin never had what's called an ICO.
Right.
And that's a great point because all these other ones, the Library, Dogecoin, whoever else, they have ICOs, initial coin right. offerings. There's a small group of centralized people who stand to make a lot of money by selling these things. Look, you're leading with your chin by calling your offering an ICO. Obviously, a take on
well,
IPO.
It's really a form of equity offering,
right?
In an enterprise, and that's what the SEC chairman Gensler is saying,
right?
And he's making he says Bitcoin is a commodity.
He says Bitcoin's a commodity,
and the
exactly.
ICOs are securities, and he's right.
There's very bright line Gensler drew right. there. I found it interesting too that there's no I didn't see any articles where someone said, hey, you know what? We're going to take this up with the First Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the circuit that would handle this New Hampshire federal district judge case. Nobody even said that. But it tells
me, I
think
it's a waste of money to take it.
Well, appeals are cheap. They're not like trials right. are expensive. Appeals are cheap. But no one's saying, hey, we're going to take this up on appeal. It tells me they're not going to do it because it's airtight. But we'll see. You never know.
Well, if there's any chance you could fight this, it's to me, it would be the Ethereum people who would fight it.
Yeah, but they
they're
can't,
the ones that have the most to lose.
They're not parties.
Right.
They can only – so in other words, you have to have library.
Well, but here's the thing that makes them parties. Now that the SEC has this decision, what are they going to do vis-a-vis the other cryptos?
Well, they would be. Here's what they're going to do. They would be parties in the next lawsuit.
There you go.
See? They're not parties in this one, but the next lawsuit would be at the district court level.
Would it be a lawsuit or an enforcement action?
Whatever the case, it's the SEC right. would make the move on.
Right. So the SEC has to make the move, but that's the question. Now with this decision in, what is the SEC's move?
What do you think it is? I think the Gensler's going to go after all of them.
Right. That's what I think.
Yeah.
Question is
why wouldn't he? He's got this precedent. It's district court, but it's either going to not be appealed or appealed and probably won.
Right.
This is not good. A lot of cryptos tanked yesterday.
Right.
On this ruling.
And the question was, it just this or was it more? I mean, Bitcoin is now down at 17,000, and Bitcoin is clearly not in the basket.
Exactly. It's Gensler himself is like, it's a commodity. It's not a right. security.
Right.
To me, yesterday is a big win for Bitcoin and a big loss for the others.
Right,
for the securities.
Bitcoin's down 2,000. So
yeah, okay.
Somebody's nervous about something.
Yeah, but it's not down 80%. You know, right. crazy numbers like that.
Right.
It's down in sympathy, but not crazy. You know, we'll see. Right. But it's a massive ruling. Right. Then we're gonna. It's going to have ramifications. I predict there are going to be ramifications from this case that we're not seeing right now.
So here's the question: is how when they're ready, how are they going to regulate the cryptos? And I've always thought there was an easier way to go after cryptos than this. So you know, and if they did what the Australians are doing with crypto. Why would you bother to spend a lot of time on this? You wouldn't. So,
yeah.
But it seems to me, one way or another, crypto's in for a difficult year next year.
Could be. But on the other hand, my question is, what impact is this decision going to have on the connection between crypto and CBDC? I don't know. I mean, this could be good news, really good news for Bitcoin and, you know, other truly mined coins.
Right. So to me, it's good news for Bitcoin, just like the...
I think so.
Was it Bank of New York or Mellon? Bank of New York, Mellon going in.
Yeah.
So I think Bitcoin has had a lot of good news recently.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I still wouldn't touch it myself, but you know, the good news is good news.
Nope, I'm not touching it either.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. What is next? We have Farmageddon next. The next two stories... Kind of want to take a step back here. You know, after the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, it really took a couple of years to kind of understand what went on.
Right.
We look back and, you know, it's like looking at a horse race to a telescope. All those horses look close together. But if you could really kind of tease it out and parse it out and do a timeline, right. you see you don't learn stuff until later. And we're learning more and more about what happened during the pandemic. And these next two stories are along these lines that paint a very clear picture. Starting to paint a clear picture of what happened.
So I just said that, you know, when I saw the Skidmore survey, I realized, okay, it's a genocide. So the revelations we're looking at are now as important, I think, as that moment. It's another moment that is that big in terms of understanding and putting the proper framework on what we're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's a big piece of the puzzle, these next two stories. It's actually one story in one video. So the story from Brownstone Institute, government's national security arm took charge during the COVID response. And there are two key dates right up front. Let me try that again. Yeah, as of March 13, 2020, the National Security Council was officially in charge of the U.S. government's COVID policy. Starting on March 18th, so 5 days later, FEMA, under the Department of Homeland Security, was officially in charge of the government's response. In other words, it's not really, they're saying, not really a pandemic, not really a health crisis. It's really being treated there as sort of a military matter almost.
Right, and we know because Trump put $10 billion behind Operation Warp Speed run by the military, mm-hmm. and there was a special contracting umbrella put together so that you could keep lots of stuff secret. So we knew that, but now we're beginning to understand the extent of the military control.
Yeah. I want to cut back to the story and show you one chart really quickly. this is a government document, that this diagram. The key thing here is that the policy for the government's, you know, COVID-19 response, the policy is being set by the National Security Council, right, and no one else.
Right.
Not the CDC, not the Health and Human Services, National Security Council, completely within the ambit of, you know, sort of a military operation.
Right.
Okay. Now, by way of that background, I want to cut to this interview of a woman named Catherine Watt, who's a really sort of been intensely researching the law and the history of the law. It's been building over the decades in order for the military to sort of inject itself into a public health crisis like the one allegedly at issue with the pandemic. Okay, I'm going to need to switch over the audio so we can hear this, but I want to play this video. And the interview is by the woman who you'll see here on the right. The interview goes on for 50 minutes, and I'm going to play a clip. It's about a minute and 17 seconds, but the clip will give you a flavor for.
So let me just mention that Sasha Latipova, who is doing the interview, was Hero of the Week on the Slayer Report 2 weeks ago. And this interview is up on the homepage. The interview that John is showing you now is up on the homepage. It's Sasha interviewing Catherine Watt. You can see it right on the homepage.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So let's roll this clip.
I was stunned by the long history of this. And so what was the earliest sort of relevant piece of law that you can trace that was changed in particular for this pandemic to occur?
I think the earliest one was the 1983 establishment of the Public Health Emergencies Program, mm-hmm, under the rubric of the Public Health Services Act, which was a 1944 law. But when Reagan and the Congress at the time put in the Public Health Emergencies section, that was the beginning of sort of concentrating much, much more power in the hands of the Health and Human Services Secretary, mm-hmm, whenever a public health emergency has been declared by the HHS Secretary. So it's a completely closed loop of, mm-hmm, once they declare it, they have all the power and they are the only one who can suspend their power because of the way they wrote the laws. To the extent that federal judges and Congress accept the premise that the executive branch can shut them out of everything after the announcement has been made.
Okay.
Right.
So you did the notion there, it's a small group in the executive branch with a set of laws that can't be appealed. And no one can even question. That's
right.
Really
and,
controlling
and we
the
saw,
crisis.
Right. We saw again and again, this magical legal form that says, okay, it's an emergency, at which point all laws can get suspended. And this expert here gets to say that the sky is green and the grass is blue, and we have to pretend it's true.
Right.
Right.
You have to pretend it's true, and you can't appeal that finding.
Right, because they have complete, there's no courts, there's no, you know, it's the expert has complete dictatorial control.
Although, as we saw, courts did begin pushing back, and pushed back to this day, which is good, but the damage was done in 2 years,
right,
where the courts basically just kind of bought into the notion, oh, there's no appeal, that's the law.
Right. And remember, there's a secret contract. Secret contracts are now being worked on by the WHO to try and give the WHO that power globally.
Right.
So they say it's an emergency because they make it up out of thin air and then everybody has to do what they say. With
right.
the exception of Liechtenstein, the Cook Islands, and a few other countries.
Right, right, so, right, right. Okay.
You know, if you have a relative in the Cook Islands, now is the time to move in with them.
So you heard Watt say that sort of the beginning of the modern development of this was 1983. Let's now turn to some charts. We'll start with a chart of Lockheed. All-time chart. Let's just look at these. You want to walk us through these?
Okay, so this is a chart of Lockheed Martin, LMT, versus the ETF, which came out later. So it came out in, you can see it when it started there. When is it?
Yeah, about 1971. Yeah.
No, that's Lockheed starts 1971. but the aerospace defense ETF ITA,
yeah,
which is the lower line, came out much earlier. So it came out in the 2000s.
More recently.
Yeah, it came out more recently. And then the bottom line, the S&P, is the S&P index.
Yeah, it comes out in the early 2000s.
Right. What this shows you is that the war machine, including satellite and space, just took over the economy. Now, Lockheed is the largest contractor of the U.S. government, and I would argue even runs the U.S. government, if anybody runs the U.S. government. So it's very much representative. You know, if you say who's the deep state,
right?
It's Lockheed Martin. I used to always tell stories about when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I would try and get fundamental financial data on my operation that I needed to just run the operation and make sure I was complying with the laws. And Lockheed was the largest payment an IT contractor, and they would refuse to give it to me, and I couldn't make them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I used to say that the Secretary of HUD did not run HUD. Lockheed ran HUD. Anyway,
yeah. Quickly, for listeners who can't see the chart, the S&P chart basically starts the same as Lockheed Martin in 1980 at, say, 0%. It's an arbitrary number. And now the S&P is up 46-45%, so 3,645. Lockheed Martin today is up 47,000%.
Right. Right. So and the aerospace defense ETA ETF is up 31%. So
no, 31,000%.
I'm sorry, 31,000%. So much more significant rise. Lockheed's much more significant than its own industry, which But what you're seeing is the war machine basically taking over the economy and crowding out the economy. And it does it because of the control of the central bankers and the treasury. You know, you're basically running the whole economy through this central point and using it for more and more central control. And that central control is backed up by the force that the defense, you know, that the weapons suppliers and satellite suppliers are providing, of which Lockheed is the number one in the world. So basically, what you're seeing is central control winning at the cost of the general economy and the health and well-being of the general people. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to show this chart, John, was if you look at what just happened in China that we talked about last week, we're watching essentially the National Defense Group, you know, the war group, take over from the trade group and the people who were, you know, sort of building the global economy and trying to export, you know, and it's we're now watching China and Russia do the same thing. The people who want to trade globally and build ties globally and have a global economy are getting pushed out. And the guys who are winning and taking over the economy are the guys who build the weapons and go to war. So, you know, Jack Ma used to always say, when trade stops, war starts.
Yeah.
So that, you know, the traders are getting pushed out by the soldiers and the bomb builders. And it's a very serious and important development. And it's very bad for the total wealth pie, because we're talking about people making money on things that destroy wealth. You know, they don't make money on things that build wealth. And so it's not a good development, but you got to understand it if you're going to change it. So let's just look at the short one.
Yeah. The year to date, the same chart.
But what it says is Lockheed's moving up even more.
Yeah.
So
year to date, the S&P is down 20%. Lockheed's up basically 40%.
Right. And that's a 60% spread.
Yeah, and the industry is up 5 or 6%.
Right. But what we saw in October is Lockheed skyrocketed up. And the question is why? You know, what happened in mid-October to cause that? There are a number of possibilities, but that's something I'm going to be spending more time on. And if anybody has any thoughts on that, I would welcome them.
Yeah, okay. So let's, there's two more charts we want to see, but I think we want to look at these after a story from Zero Hedge about the funeral business. Okay. The funeral business is booming, not because of COVID. And basically the story here is a comparison of two sort of sectors, Today, Service Corporation International, SCI, the largest for-profit funeral operator in North America, had its quarterly earnings call. Its stock is up over 15% since last week's earnings report. And they show a chart rocketing up. This is a funeral operator, okay? Contrast that with, keep it going here, Lincoln Financial announced results last week, and it's basically the opposites. Its shares collapsed over 30% after a shocking and unexpected $2.6 billion third quarter loss. What business is Lincoln Financial in, you ask? Well, it's a Pennsylvania life insurance and annuities company, and it is just getting crushed. So now let's cut back to the charts and go to a chart of those two. You can see these two different companies.
Right.
Here's the year-to-date. Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
The year-to-date, okay. And you have SCI, which is, you know, it's up basically like the aerospace industry, 4%. And then Lincoln, the funeral operator, is down 50% on the year.
Yeah. So, wow. So Lincoln, the life insurance is down 50%.
Yeah.
So if you read the earnings announcements, what was so shocking about the earnings announcements is Service Corporation is describing the fact that their market grows maybe 1% to 2% a year. You know, that it's not volatile. There aren't big swings. There aren't big growth. It's just sort of a steady, steady market. And then suddenly the growth is exploding in ways that have to be very difficult operationally for them to handle. They're describing something that is so out of the box in terms of a growth pattern. Sounds to me like they've never dealt with anything like this before. But for them, it's shocking.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's so...
Right.
The growth pattern is so unpredicted, unexplainable, blah, 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 blah.
So let's look at the one-month chart. You want
to
see shocking.
Okay,
here's the chart. 1 month for the funeral operator at the top, up 20%. And the life insurance Lincoln down 26-27% in
right.
a month.
And it's up 20% in a down market, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
So then you listen to the Lincoln earnings call, and what you realize, it's much more pretzel talk because they've got a much more difficult situation to handle. What is happening is because of the explosion, the out-of-box explosion in death claims, they are not only having to pay out a lot more money, but they have to rewrite all the actuarially assumptions for their whole portfolio, which is not only a major job, but could devastate their financials far worse than just 1 year's, you know, bad earnings. I mean, this could bankrupt the company. So,
right.
And, you know, this is what we've been saying. At some point, it's going to show up on the insurance side. And this is proof positive that things are happening now, which you can't hide. You cannot hide the explosion of deaths in terms of what it's doing to funeral homes. You can't not hide what it's doing to the life insurance companies. And if you have life insurance companies in your portfolio, any companies impacted by high all death, you know, a big rise in all cause mortality, you should be calling up your financial planner and financial advisor and saying, okay, you know, what is a major genocide going to do to my portfolio? I mean, the way to push back on this is to pick up the phone and call BlackRock, call Larry Fink, call Vanguard and say, okay,
yeah,
you know, what's this going to do to my portfolio and what are you doing about it?
Yeah. Hey, you know, Aunt Myrna just got out of surgery. They pulled out a foot long blood clot. Well, how's that affect my portfolio? It's a foot long. It was growing. It's getting bigger.
Right.
Can't hide that, can you?
Yeah, don't push back to the government. Push back to the money guys. I'm serious.
Right. No, that's a great idea. I love that.
Right.
Yeah. How's that affect my portfolio, Larry? Okay. Okay.
How does the genocide fit with the ESG or ESG goals for the year, Larry?
Right. Exactly. Okay, next story. This is out of the EU. This is total whitewash from Politico. EU prosecutor's office opens investigation into COVID vaccine purchases. Oh, do tell. The European Public Prosecutor's Office, EPPO, has opened an investigation into the EU's coronavirus vaccine purchases, an announcement that will refocus attention on EC President Ursula von der Leyen's role in the matter. Okay? So what's the rub here? Budget Watchdog found that the EU chief deviated from the playbook established in previous vaccine negotiations to personally hash out a preliminary deal with the U.S. multinational instead of relying on joint negotiating teams. That doesn't sound very serious, does it? Deviated from the playbook in previous negotiations and personally hashed out a preliminary deal instead of relying on a committee. Unlike with any of the other contracts, the commission refused to provide the court with any documents regarding preliminary negotiations for that specific deal. Yeah, here's my response to that. So what?
So
that, do you really think that's the worst of that story? I don't think
No, the worst of the story is that that von der Leyen's husband runs a company, which is a subsidiary of Pfizer.
Right, but my point is that Politico is just completely pulling its punches there.
So here's what the interesting thing is. If you look at what's going on in Europe, Europe is going through a very, the politics of Europe. Europe is very much in a squeeze by the U.S., and you've just now made the president of the EU subject to, you know, incredible blackmail all the way through. If she doesn't behave and do what everybody wants, you know, they've got her.
Right, right.
You know, that woman has a control file, as far as I'm concerned, the size of Europe.
Yeah, right, right. The woman, you got that right. A woman has a control file the size of Europe. Indeed, she does. Anyway, I mean, who knows what kind of graft and corruption is going on? You know, we're going to find out that Borla and these guys were in knee deep with these military contractors.
Well, if you look at the Pfizer's stock price, and just you watch, I'm assuming a lot of the money that came in went out as kickbacks. I just think Pfizer was a kickback machine.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's a death machine. And right. These guys, there's the Politico story is, oh, well, she didn't rely on the committee.
So
made
while
this decision.
You're at it, I want you to call BlackRock and Vanguard and your financial advisor and ask them why they're investing in a stock, you know, like Pfizer that's destroying your other stocks, like your Lincoln Financial stock.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. If they're going to buy Pfizer, they should sell all the life insurance companies and just buy funeral homes, right?
Right. Exactly.
Right. Right.
Did you short your life insurance companies, Larry? Yeah.
That's what I could never, I wrote a letter to the New York Times about this on private prison companies about the fact that, you know, why invest in Fannie Mae if you're just going to invest in private prison companies and drugs in a way that's going to destroy your Fannie Mae stock. I mean, of course, the government bailed it out. So
yeah,
there you go.
There you go. Right. There you go. Okay, last story of Farmageddon. This is important. It's a local story from Boise, Idaho, the Idaho Dispatch. What's going on here? It's kind of a noisy website. Boise School District is administering a youth mental health survey to all students in junior high and high school in English classes last Thursday, November 3rd, and Friday, November 4th. The only way parents are able to opt their children out is through the link in the email. The link does not show the questions to the parents. So what are those questions? These images show some of the questions that are included in the survey being administered to 6th through 12th graders. How would you describe your romantic interest in others? First choice, I am romantically interested in others who are a different gender of me. Second, I am romantically interested in others who are the same gender as me. I am romantically interested in all genders. I'm unsure. Anyway, these are the kind of questions they're putting to sixth graders in a survey.
Right. So I've had teachers tell me about some of these surveys and, and they are sworn to not make the information available to parents.
Wow.
So the reason I wanted to cover this story is if you have children in either public schools or private schools that might give them a survey, you need to teach your children under no circumstance to answer any of these surveys. I assure you, this data is going to many places where it is not safe. It is not private.
Yeah.
You should just assume this data will be publicly available to members of organized crime syndicates. And you know, you just need to understand this data is dangerous and can be weaponized against you. And if you look at what's been done to kids to make them, you know, feel not, or to make them feel in a position where they would say they're depressed. I mean, that information can then be used against them and against you and your family. So you need to understand a lot has been done to the kids, whether it was lockdowns or even the vaccines. Sushrut Bhakti just did an interview on USA Watchdog and talked about how the clotting is cutting off the oxygen in the brain and is causing people to have their cognition slip or to feel depressed or feel unhappy, blah, 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 blah. And you don't have, you know, you have a poisoning problem. You don't have a mental health problem. So whatever you do, do not let your kids answer any of these surveys. Just refuse.
That is really interesting. You have a poisoning problem.
Right.
Not, children. So don't let them put you in that bucket. Tell your kids, I'm not answering any questions without my attorney here.
Right.
That's exactly what the kids ought to say. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Get my attorney here, so I'll answer your questions.
So the children are being mentally, physically, and emotionally poisoned.
Yeah.
I mean, they're being poisoned. And you have to, one, you have to protect them against that poisoning. But two, you cannot let them answer surveys that will translate the symptoms of that poisoning into something that can be weaponized against you and your family.
Yeah. Boy, what's going on is just evil. There's no other way to put
it. Well, think of, I mean, I hate to say this, the people running this see these children as livestock to be taken advantage of.
Yeah.
They're running a covert personnel department. They've been doing it for centuries. So this is not new. It's just digitized, you know. I mean, I grew up in this system, and you would literally watch them track children from birth, but it was all very quiet and invisible. Now it's, you know, it's coming out front.
Right.
But this data will go into databases that the intelligence agencies and corporations will use to sort of sort the kids out for different functions that have nothing to do with your hopes and dreams for the kids or their own hopes and dreams for themselves. They're going to be steered and targeted. You know, if they say they're romantically interested in people of their own sex or they want to change their sex, the next thing you know, they're going to be targeted online by people trying to persuade them to get surgery.
Yeah. You know it. They're going to sell that data.
Right.
No question about it.
Right.
No question. You don't think a private company is behind that survey? You're out of your mind. You know?
I don't know. You know, it's funny because I was Assistant Secretary of Housing and I know what used to happen to data because a lot of times you'd see the civil service swap it to Wall Street in exchange for different kinds of favors. So, you know, you can play kickbacks with data too.
And, I'll bet.
Yeah. So, you know, one of my favorite quotes is data about money is worth more than money in a digital age.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, when you get these forms from the government, I used to do this when I was investment advisor, they'd say, oh, well, the government says the data is secure. And I would just break out laughing. I said, you know, that government's, you know, that any data you give to the U.S. government is not secure.
Yeah.
Full stop. Not. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Let's move on to kickback. Move on to kickbacks. It's a new section on money markets. Unfortunately, it's 7 hours long because there's
moved up. No, we'll shorten it up and just have it be the people who aren't taking kickbacks.
So we're calling it pushback to make it under 30 minutes. Okay. But let's go to a video. This is Claire Daly. I'm gonna switch over the audio.
Somebody who's not taking kickbacks.
We're gonna switch to Claire Daly. We've seen her before. you gotta love her. Let's just go here.
State sponsor of terrorism is a term of US law. It doesn't exist in EU law. But a Zelensky advisor called for it in the Parliament magazine, and here we are again reporting for duty. And all it will do is make peace harder to achieve. Exactly, of course, what the extremists want. No peace, no off-ramps, all bridges burning, and Ukraine a permanent abattoir in a suicidal holy crusade against Russia. So, if you want to start naming state sponsors of terrorism, let's do it. European sponsorship of Israeli terrorism in Palestine, Western sponsorship of Saudi terror in Yemen, ISIS, the product of French, American, British, Turkish, and Gulf sponsorship in Syria and Iraq. Decades of right-wing US-backed terrorism against the Cuban Revolution, the Contras in Nicaragua, death squads in Guatemala, in El Salvador, remember Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, horror after horror, terror after terror. There's nothing constructive about the pot calling the kettle black. Would you ever cop on, start championing peace and end the war, which is patently in the interests of EU, Ukrainian and Russian citizens?
Don't you just love the Irish?
Tell us how you really feel. Holy cow. That is just fantastic. Anyway, okay, let's keep it going. The next story is a welcome scene. Top U.S. banks under investigation over ESG and climate action. Ah, now we know why the CEOs are moving in that direction. The banks appear to be colluding with the UN to destroy American companies and undermine the nation's best interest. One of the attorneys general, so what we got here is a coalition of 19 state attorneys general from across the country investigating the ESG movement here. They're saying, they're warning they're warning these companies that you're colluding with the UN, you're destroying American companies. The new investigation is the latest salvo by Republican-led states amid growing nationwide concerns about the woke policies of financial institutions and other powerful business interests. Multiple attorneys general who spoke to the Epoch Times, which is the author of this story, about the probe said it was their job to enforce consumer protection laws and protect citizens in their states from potentially illegal activity by companies up to and including ESG activity. Isn't that great?
Go state AGs. I love it.
I do too.
Right.
Anyway, so next story along, this is really in line with our theme from Quote the Raven. We need COVID accountability, not amnesty. Okay. So there have been several recent large wins for the unvaccinated. Okay. A majority of the media and Democrats have demanded that these people be removed from society and generally subject to scorn and ridicule. Now, in a moment that many of us knew would eventually be coming, apologies are being made around the world for how the unvaccinated were treated. Fox News said the premier of Alberta, Canada, said she is working on a plan to pardon residents who were fined or arrested over breaking coronavirus protocols and apologize to the unvaccinated Canadians who face discrimination. But then the article goes on and says, a lot of these so-called apologies are mealy-mouthed given the behavior that went on. And they cited an Atlantic article, and this author says, the Atlantic article can lead me only to only one conclusion. Many on the left simply don't know how to apologize. Here's a little tip for the Atlantic and its mealy-mouthed apologies. Next time you do this, write a piece focused on apologizing instead of issuing orders about how exactly, when, and why people should be forgiving you.
So here's the extraordinary thing about the Atlantic piece demanding forgiveness. It's written by a woman named Emily Oster, and her title, her former title, is J.J.E. Goldman Sachs Professor of Economics at Brown University.
You have to be kidding me.
No, I'm serious. She's funded by Goldman Sachs. You can't make this up. So now here's the thing. If she's a professor of economics, she should be able to calculate how immensely profitable the pandemic was for Goldman Sachs.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So she's financed with the profits from the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely right.
Right. So maybe she got funded before the pandemic, but net, she's being funded by organized crime.
Yeah.
And she's asking for forgiveness for organized crime without mentioning that when they are forgiven under her construct, they get to keep all their profits from their organized crime.
Yeah.
Which is why, in our theme, remedies includes, taking people back to where you were, which includes giving back all the money you stole.
Right.
Right.
Right. And accountability for the lives you took, you know, I mean.
Well, but here's why you shouldn't send your children to Brown University. I mean, Brown University was also the university that funded the professor who would write about genocide, who was financed by John Berkland and Brown University's profits on private prison companies that I wrote about the Dylan Reed book.
Yeah, right, right.
So Brown University has this tradition of coming up with academics financed by, you know, the perpetrators to right, come up with these, right, these different theories on why the perpetrator should be forgiven. But why should you spend, how much does it cost to go to Brown University for a year? 50, 60,000?
Oh, gotta be 60, yeah.
Okay, so let's say it's 60K. Why should you pay 60K for your children to learn economics from a professor of economics who can't even count?
Yeah, right.
I mean, is it fair to say that Emily can't count?
Right. Yeah, it's very fair.
Why, right, why would you, especially when they're going to mandate a vaccination that's going to poison your child?
Yeah, yeah. Plus, it's clear, you know, the Ivy League schools, really, if you think about it, they're really sold as like they give you connections. But the Ivy League in that name, that brand, is really the cover story. Those connections existed already for the kids getting in there, for the most part, by themselves on an education for education basis. The Ivies have no advantage over similarly situated schools.
So I graduated from the University of Pennsylvania undergraduate and Wharton MBA graduate. It's Wharton is the Penn Business School. So I told you, I just looked at their website and they require vaccinations. Why yeah, would you go to a school where everybody's stupid enough to do that?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Right. It's for the connection. As a middle-class person, I would tell you, well, you would go there for the connections. But I'm telling you, if you really study it, those connections aren't available to you because you're from the middle class. They're available to
you. Well, they're not available to you if you're in a coffin in a cemetery or cremated.
Certainly not in that circumstance. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you have better chances with connections if you're alive.
You know, you have a better chance to go 2 years of welding college.
Exactly. You make a lot more money. You
make a lot more money at a more right, productive job.
So $250,000 plus out the door, when you could go to welding school, not get vaccinated, live, right, and right,
and go to sleep at night.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
More pushback.
I'm totally in on welding school here.
Yeah, I know. I tell my nephews, go take an apprenticeship. Okay, next story. Sweden will not meet Agenda 2030. I love this. New Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson is not heeding the green agenda. He promptly eliminated the entire Ministry of Climate and Environment, marking the first time in 35 years that Sweden does not have a specific climate ministry. People are crying that the world will crumble without funding bureaucrats who pretend they have the ability to alter the weather cycle with enough funding. Dynamite.
Well, this is good. And this guy's got a problem because they canceled 6 of the 12 nuclear plants. And you can't just create 6 new nuclear plants out of thin air.
Yeah.
So they got a right, real problem.
They do.
But apparently, it's one of our subscribers said that the group in the climate ministry was, they were pretty wacko. So the wackos have been cleared out. And here's the thing, when people have energy bills going up 20, 30, 40, 50%, or businesses, because we're going to look at some stock charts that show you the energy yeah, is really, you know, stock market investors are feeling the pain of yeah, many companies experiencing higher energy costs. You know, it's down to nut cutting time and people don't have time for the hooey. So
yeah, they don't.
So the wacko's right, got to go.
Yeah.
Which is a good sign. Okay.
Final story. It's not a story in pushback. Final entry in pushback from the Episcopal Academy founded in 1785 in Pennsylvania. They have here a sweater. They're encouraging people to buy called the Stripes, and the Stripes correspond to these values they have: self-control, faith, honesty, courtesy, kindness, generosity, gratitude, courage, respect, and sportsmanship. That's just good old-fashioned.
So, I ran into the Stripes when I was in Pennsylvania. Yeah. And I have to tell you, here's a school with a high tuition that's worth sending your kids to. I went to Friends Select, which was a Quaker school in Philadelphia, and we were in the Interact League with Episcopal. So it was a school that I grew up with. But I bumped into the Stripes system when I was visiting, and it's wonderful because the kids were really engaged in it. They were talking about it. You could say, well, how does your behavior here compare with this Stripe and da 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 da. You know, it was a living, breathing system. And in addition to having these sweaters with the five stripes on each arm, you've got, you know, there was one tool that listed all the stripes that was up against the refrigerator. So it's kind of like my old church in Hickory Valley. When you went to the bathroom, the Ten Commandments were sitting there on the wall facing you, and you couldn't miss them. They were right, you know, in your face. But I loved this system, and I loved, you know, I went to a couple of events at the school, and I loved what they're doing in terms of teaching kids how to build character. It was pretty wonderful, and you thought, you know, there's somebody here is just going full bore in human civilization. They've decided to ignore bizarro worlds.
Yeah, exactly. Ignore right. woke world and just go with old, good old-fashioned values.
Right.
And push those. And that counts now as pushback.
I'll never forget one. The first week I was there, somebody said, you want to come to chapel with us? Because they have a chapel and parents and guests are invited. And they said, oh, you got to come to chapel. It's fabulous. Now, when have you heard people talk about, oh boy, let's go to chapel? You know, but if you look at what they're doing, it's pretty
I went to Episcopal school for the first 5 years, first through fifth grade. I never spoke that way about chapel. And really? I went every day. Chapel had the upside of chapel was it class.
Yeah. So here what they're doing is they're really trying to use chapel to help inspire people to, you know, it's rejuvenating and it's inspirational. So
yeah, right. Yeah.
And we need that. I don't know about you. We need that. So
in a big way, we need it. Yeah.
Big compliments. Check out the website, because if you look at the Stripes in the Episcopal Academy, anybody can do it.
You mentioned fees and expenses with Episcopal, and I'm not a parent. I can't really weigh into this, but I did look at that. And tuition and fees, they go up to $39.9 in the 12th grade, but down to, if memory serves, $30 in the lower grades.
Right.
That doesn't strike me as that crazy for Pennsylvania.
No. No, I would say somebody's kept a lid, you know, on that. And the schools like this, I don't know about Episcopals, but the whole Interact League and the Quaker schools tried very hard to provide scholarships. So and I was at the Halloween parade, and I can say you've got a lot of kids from a very diverse background. You know, you've got kids from other countries, and you know, it's a pretty amazing group.
Yeah, anyway,
anybody can use the Stripes. Check out the website.
Okay, let's move on to charts. As always, starting with FinViz. Here we go. The year performance. Just to point out a few standouts. The VIX, up toward the top, at the top five, but the very top is natural gas. It's up 66-67%. Look at that.
So we're in a world of real risk because, you know, the VIX hasn't been this positive for this long for quite a while. But here's the thing. If the Fed doesn't pivot when, you know, you and I would expect or the market would expect it to, then the VIX is going to go into a whole new world. So, you know, this we'll see where it goes next year. But this is a very new world. And as you can see, interest rates and higher energy prices is clobbering a lot of the commodity. You know, it looked last year like we were off to a commodities bull, but no longer.
It did. Another thing that jumps out to me about this chart, there are a lot of currencies negative. If Canadian dollar is the best of the lot at minus 6%, down to the Japanese yen, down 21%.
Wow. Well, the US dollar is the winner against everybody.
Except the ruble.
Right. Getting
crushed by the ruble. Now at 61. Okay. Let's keep it going here with charts. Here we have VDE. What is that?
So that's that's the Vanguard Energy ETF.
Okay.
Or energy funds. So I wanted to take a look at energy. And if you look at the gold line or the orange line, that's the GLD, the gold ETF.
So down minus.
Year to date. Yeah, so down almost 7%. Miners down 19.3%, so significantly more than gold.
Right.
And I think there's several reasons for that, but one is the energy costs. Miners need energy, a lot of energy to do mining. And what we see across the board on most businesses, you know, in the U.S., labor, energy is a bigger cost in manufacturing than labor. So this is a real drag on many, many stocks. And I think that's part of what's got the miners significantly underperforming the gold price.
So VDE, the energy ETF, is up 57%.
Right.
Just crushing gold and the gold miners. Wow.
Right.
Okay. Then we have Goldman Sachs. I know that ticker symbol.
Well, here's the thing. Goldman's flying up with Lockheed, and it makes you wonder, okay. And it started at the same time, mid-October. And, you know, it looks to me like Goldman and Lockheed are planning on making a lot of money on the Ukraine. But, you know, so Goldman's still down for the year, S&P much more. But the one that is surprising is TLT, the long treasury, down 34% for the year. That's the long treasury ETF.
Yeah, that's shocking.
Yeah, it is shocking. Especially because, go back to my numbers on Skidmore's numbers, if you've got to borrow money to pay the interest on your debt, this is making it very expensive. Yep.
Great point.
Yep.
Okay. Next chart we've got. That was the last chart.
There were some others, but
hold on.
Don't worry about it.
Let me. No, I can. I can. Let me just hit this. There are other charts. No, that was it.
Okay. Well, let's go on to domicile. One of the questions we get constantly, John, is what is the best jurisdiction? Where should I live?
Yeah.
And this was a this was an article. It's very much geared to people who live in RVs, and so they need they may have a state of domicile that's different than their state of residence. So this is an article that goes through many of the different issues, and it's very. If you're living in an RV or living in a mobile, have a mobile existence, it's one you may want to read.
Yeah. And there's a follow-up. There's another piece that we'll have in the show notes and the links, which is an article about why we chose Nevada as our domicile state, which works through a personal example of you know the issues that you face when choosing domicile.
Right.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Let's move on to Hero of the Week.
So Brian Palliser is somebody we've talked about many times in Money and Markets and on the Salera Report. He was the head of Manitoba, who during the pandemic warned everybody about the weather warfare problem.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, so I showed it when I spoke at the Weston Price Conference, and the audience, I was explaining, you know, that he'd done this, and the audience booed, and I said, don't boo him. This man did us a huge service. You ought to clap for him. You know, are you kidding?
Right,
this was
a
very brave and courageous thing he did. And so then everybody started to clap. And I decided, okay, it's time to make Brian Hero of the Week and help people understand that any politician who's willing to give us, you know, a tip about what's going on in terms of the secret pressure on sovereign governments to, you know, to do these things and to act against the best interests of their constituents. You know, they do us a huge service every time they, you know, they slip a tip like this. And
yeah,
then and Brian's was basically the number one tip of the pandemic, in my opinion.
It was a pretty big one. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And we're coming Thursday, Solution Series with Franklin Sanders.
Yeah. So Corey Diggs is doing every other week. We're publishing a Solution Series. We sort of a joint effort with Corey. She's doing it on her website too. And she wanted to sit after listening to our interviews with Franklin this year, including on the building wealth one in the second quarter, she wanted to interview Franklin. And so she, when she was in Tennessee for the conference, she did, and we're publishing it this week. I should also mention the feedback from subscribers when I was in the United States is they love the Solution Series. So Corey has agreed she will continue it through July, and then we'll revisit it, but it'll be 1 year straight. And so they say, you know, give us more actions of things we can do. So that's one of the things we're going to be focusing on over the next year.
Great. Yeah. I met Corey in Tennessee.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. She was there anonymously. So.
Yeah. I said, are you crashing the party here? She introduced herself. I said, I don't remember seeing you anyway. And so I said, you're party crashing, aren't you? She said, yeah.
Yeah. So she wanted to remain secret, but she's fabulous. She's doing a great job. And it's just it's a pleasure to know her. And she's on them. She's doing the same thing you are. She's on them like a diamond drill bit. And she's working on one on immunity. Did you see her part one on sovereign immunities? So as we were writing about the BIS and the bank, she was writing about everybody else who's got sovereign immunity. She did a part one. She's working on a part two.
No, I don't recall reading something. I would have remembered immunity about people other than the authors of the immunity.
Well, it's remarkable because what the banks have done is they have created all of these organizations with sovereign immunity. And you really are watching a breakaway civilization because these guys are above the law. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, you're also going to, there can't be, my dad used to say this, and it's true. It can't be two kings in a kingdom.
Right.
Eventually, there's going to be infighting and we're going to find out who's going to stop who.
Right. Right. We're watching it now.
Yeah.
Infighting's upon us now.
Yep.
Okay. So our theme was?
Remedies and the rule of law.
Right. So that's the question. Can we implement the rule of law?
Oh, I don't know, Catherine. That's a big one.
It is a big one, but you can start by calling your financial planner and broker and asking them, what is genocide going to do to your portfolio?
Yeah, and you can start by holding your leaders' feet to the fire too. Remember, fear is a big part of the rule of law. Healthy fear is rulers fearing their constituents, not the other way around. The other way around. Constituents fearing their leaders is a sign of tyranny and totalitarianism. We don't want that.
Right.
The fear should be cutting in the other direction.
Unfortunately, the election results show that they no longer fear the voting box.
Boy. Oh, well, there'll be more fallout on the election next week, I'm sure.
We're going to have a lot to talk about next week and when it comes to the election. Okay, John Titus. Thank you very much for joining us on Money and Markets. Anything else you want to say before we go?
I'm working on a video now on CBDC and legal tender.
Fabulous.
There was an interesting seminar held by the IMF in which there were some rather telltale nuggets dropped by this one person. Anyway.
So, some of the QAnon folks were predicting that the CBDC would be issued in 2 to 3 months. If the Democrats hold the Senate. I think that's the most absurd thing I've ever heard. But got any thoughts on what's the fastest you think they could try and do a CBDC in the United States?
Barring a major event or catastrophe, it would be 3 years. But
okay.
That's
I would have said 2 years.
That's a big... It's a major undertaking to do this. Let's go with 2 years.
Right.
But that's a pretty major caveat I'm issuing there because I would not bar a major event or a catastrophe. I wouldn't rule that out at this point. These criminals will do anything to hold on to their power. Remember that.
So here's the problem you have, and it's happening in China, it's happening in Russia, and it's happening here. You have the national security guys taking over. And they're taking over at a time when the economy is in the debt spiral. And they have only one way through, and that's control and force.
Yeah.
They're committed. You have the three most powerful military powers in the world now committed to an economic plan of total control.
Right. Right. They'll do anything to hold on to their power, and I mean anything.
Right.
That's what happens when the gloves come off the crime.
Right.
You open the gates.
Right.
Anyway.
Okay. Get ready to duck.
Or worse. Okay, we will see you next week.
Thank you, John. Have a great week, everyone.